Good morning. Happy three-day weekend or something like that for those of you who get to play tomorrow. Since I'm retired from my other job, I'm just in a permanent situation of play, more or less. So today I want to talk about dreams and wakefulness. And I'm going to talk off of a prose poem by Chuang Tzu, whom we're studying in our study group, in our morning study group. Chuang Tzu, the 4th century before the contemporary era Taoist. So, and this is his most famous quote. So those of you, some of you may know it pretty well. Chuang Tzu. Last night I dreamed I was a butterfly, flitting from flower to flower. Or am I a butterfly now, dreaming he is Chuang Tzu, flitting from word to word? This is called the transformation of things. Four dimensions to that I want to talk about today. So the first dimension, dreaming and waking are both important and not that different. They're both important and not that different. And how do we even know when we're dreaming? How do we know when we're what we're perceiving is real and when it's not? And is the me, is the Tim, is the Matt of the dreams, is that Matt with its various dream characters the same Matt as the waking character Matt with his different characters, or different? And in dreams, sometimes in our bad dreams, we have strong negative emotions, right? We have strong feelings. They're just as vivid and intense as when we're awake. We're just as hurt. We're just as offended. We're just angry. If you hadn't had a dream like that, then I'm giving you a suggestion. You can have a dream like that tonight. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Just before Memorial Day. But then you wake up from that dream, and it's all gone. It's all gone. You go, whew, whew. It's all gone. But what about these negative emotions that we carry around in waking lives? And then at some point, they drop away, and they're all gone. Whew. So what's what? If we can do it in our dream state, maybe we can do it in our waking state too. Maybe we can just let it go, let it drop, like when we wake up. Maybe that's even Zen practice. Maybe not. And then in Buddhism and in indigenous shamanic cultures, in much of Buddhism, there's something called dream time. Not so much in the Zen that was passed on to me from my Japanese teacher. Teachers, plural. But in Chinese Zen, I worked with a Chinese teacher when I was young in San Francisco named Tolan. Tolan was kind of a weird Zen teacher. Well, that's fine. You know, to be a Zen teacher and be weird is okay. That's why I really like it, because I get to be weird. My natural instinctual weirdness, people think, is profound. So, wow, what a deal. What a deal. So Tolan, he pulled up his shirt. On this robe, he wore like a yellow robe, a yellow-orange robe. He pulled up his shirt after he'd given his talk before we did Zazen, and he'd show us the scars on his belly from where he had burned moksha, M-O-X-A, moksha burning. And I'd never seen my Japanese teachers do anything like that, especially in the Zendo. There he was pulling it up, telling us about it. Talked to us about practicing in a cave in China for years. He talked about doing long fasting in the cave. And then he talked about a wolf coming to visit him while he was sitting in the cave. Then he talked about the wolf coming back and visiting him in dream time. I thought, oh, this is much more interesting than what Suzuki's doing with me. Much more. Wow. Wow. So I actually went back and forth between the two centers for a while. Although his center was just three or four people, and he didn't speak a word of English. Three or four people and a Chinese translator. And he said, the wolf came to me in dream time and told me about America. And told me I should come to America. I didn't know anything about America, but I did what the wolf said. I came to America. And the wolf said I would be very successful in America. And I thought, and he said, well, and look. He seemed like he thought he was very successful. It was this little tiny apartment in San Francisco with four of us coming once a week. Oh, look, he said, look. But later, after I left, he some wealthy Chinese people became his students, and he opened the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Northern California. And he had many, many disciples, ordained many people, had many disciples. So I guess that wolf was pretty smart. Pretty smart wolf. So dream time. 20 years later, after that, after I had been after I'd been here at Zen Center practicing for some time, I left Zen Center for a while and did dream time practicing on my own, working with a guy named Michael Harner and a guy named Elmer Running. And lo and behold, in my dream time journeying, this is actual practicing, a wolf came and met me, and very friendly, licked my face, and that wolf became my friend then for, I don't know. No, this wolf is still my friend. Just don't talk about it much here. Became my dreamtime friend, and gave me lots of support, and introduced me to a whole other menagerie of friends, including a turtle whom I've talked a lot about before. You guys thought I was just being metaphorical. But everything literal is metaphorical, and everything metaphorical is literal. So who cares? Who cares? And so are these dreamtime characters real or not? Who cares? If they help us cultivate generosity, compassion, who cares? That's our goal. If our dream time helps us that way, that's wonderful. Suzuki Roshi, my first teacher, talked about this kind of experience as being a letter from emptiness, a letter from Buddha's world, helping us live a deeper life. So we can treasure these kinds of experiences when they come up. And of course, they only come up very intermittently often, and not at all when we really want them. That's okay. That's okay. Just be patient. Just do our turtle practice. So, in the mid-90s, and then night dreams, too. Night dreams can tell us stuff. Of course, we have night dreams that are just emptying the garbage can. Most of my night dreams, it seems like it's just like I'm just emptying the garbage can. All this stuff is piled up during the day, and then I wake up in the morning and I say, oh, I emptied the whole garbage can. Meaning that, you know, a lot of weird, kind of crazy stuff happened and all kinds of emotion. And you must know about this. Unless you're, I think you all know about this pretty well, pretty intimately. But also, once in a while, if we practice, really engage our practice, we have kind of a profound night dream that guides us. So after I had been gone from Zen Center for a few years, doing my, I was still doing my zazen, but also doing my shamanic work, I had a night dream. And in the night dream, my first teacher, Suzuki, was there. And I think this is in my book, but I'm not sure. And he was building a rock wall, a wall out of rocks. That's what he liked to do. That was his favorite thing, to work with rocks. He didn't even take his robes off, and his wife would always be on his case for being out there working with rocks and building rock walls. And he had the big guys working with him, not me. I didn't get to, because I was a little guy, you know, the lifting the rocks and putting them in place. So I had a dream in the mid-90s. See, my teacher died in 71. In the mid-90s, I had this dream, and there he was working with rocks. And then he was beckoning to me. He said, "Come here." And I said, "What?" He said, "Help me work with these rocks." He said, he didn't say it. It was all nonverbal. You know, I'm building something here. And I said, "Well, you've got lots of people helping you." He said, "Yeah, but I want you to help me with these rocks." He didn't say that. I just felt that. Do you know how dreams are sometimes? I just felt that. So then I came back to Zen Center. It's true. It's a true story. And here I am, working with rocks. So then I took over and became guiding teacher here at Zen Center about 15 or 16 years ago. And the first year, and probably every couple of years, until I wrote about it. Be careful about writing about something that's sort of profound. I would have a dream. Probably I had six or eight dreams over those first 12 years in which Suzuki would be there. My teacher would be there. And I would say to him, "I thought you were dead." And he would just roar with laughter, and then the dream ended. The same dream I had probably six, eight times. As soon as I talked about it, wrote it, I never had it again. Oh, be careful. So dreams can be helpful to us. And also they can tell us about the state of our garbage can psyche. Both. So dreaming and waking are both important and not that different. And the second step of the Eightfold Path is all about dreaming, isn't it? Aspiring, right thought, right aspiration. I'm aspiring to manifest the sense of interdependence and communion with all life that I learned in the first step. I'm aspiring. That's my dream. To align myself with that imagination, with that dream. If you want to become a writer, you have to imagine yourself writing and then do it. I have a friend who retired from a professional job. He did a young retirement because he wanted to play the piano. He played the piano all his life, but never had time because he was so busy. So That was his dream, to play the piano. And my other friend said, "Yes," and he plays about 2 hours a day. And this was about 3 or 4 years ago. 2 hours a day. And I said, "Wow, that's good." And he said, "Yeah, but this is what he really deeply wants to do. This is his dream." And I said, "And how is it?" He said, "I leave." And I said, "You leave?" He said, "Yeah, he's not very good." Well, then 3 years later, he's still playing, and I'm invited to this little recital. And I said, I thought you said you leave. He said, "Yeah, but he's been practicing for 3 years since I said that, and now it's sounding beautiful. So as much as possible, we act as if our dream, whatever it is, were our reality. We live as though it is our reality. We don't feel calm when we sit down to meditate at first, maybe at second, maybe at third. But we practice sitting calmly because we have a dream of being calm, of feeling interconnected. Even though we're not calm, over and over ago we do it. Over and over. And what happens? The dream begins to manifest itself as reality. It just happens. It just happens. I know the phrase that I use some people don't like, but we fake it until we make it. We fake it until we make it. So, Jennifer Lawrence. Anybody doesn't know who Jennifer Lawrence is? You don't know who... Oh, you guys don't know who Jennifer Lawrence is. You don't watch movies much, huh? Well, Jennifer Lawrence is an actress who's 26 years old and been an Academy Award winner and been in a lot of movies and a lot of people are in love with her, including me. just to tell you the truth, just to be completely honest. Of course, she doesn't know my age, but she doesn't need to, right? So, Jennifer Lawrence. She saw herself as an actress. She had this dim image of herself as an actress when she was 14. And she talked her parents into spending the summer in New York at 14. Trying acting, doing it. Her mom was a pushover, I guess. Or she saw that she really loved her daughter and saw she had that dream. So they spent, she's from some place like Kentucky, I can't remember. But they spent the summer in New York when she was 14. Then she came home and she took all the acting classes she could in her little high school. And she tried to graduate early because she wanted to go to Hollywood. So she was able to graduate at 16 instead of 18, 2 years earlier. And then she talked her family, you can read about it, this is true, you guys, into moving out to Southern California. So they all moved out to Southern California at 16. Then for 3 years, from 16 to 19, she had almost no success. I mean, almost no. But she kept doing it. She kept going to tryouts. She kept acting in small community theater. She kept it. She kept it. And she kept doing it. Then at 19, she had a chance to be the heroine in Winter's Bone. Any of you see Winter's Bone? Yeah. Well, not very many of you. Winter's Bone. Well, she had to uglify herself for Winter's Bone. She wanted to be... an actress who was beautiful and, you know, romantic, but she took a role where she really had to uglify herself. And she uglified herself for her dream. I think did she win an Academy Award for that one? I don't know. But it was wonderful. It was a wonderful performance. So we have to uglify ourselves for our dream. You might feel pretty ugly when you're sitting facing the wall for a whole day retreat. Well, that's part of the whole deal, you guys. To be willing to do that. Be willing to do that. Last night I dreamed I was a butterfly flitting from flower to flower. Or am I a butterfly now dreaming he is Chuang-Tzu flitting from word to word? This is called the transformation of things. So, the first dimension that I just talked about, dreaming and waking are both important and not that different. The second dimension, our dream partly is that we'll be able to awaken from the dream of cut-offness, of separateness, of always all of the stuff inside preventing us from really engaging and really enjoying the world. So that's our dream. And Chuang-Tzu talks in another place about this. He says, someday there will be a great awakening when you know that it is all a dream. And of course, interestingly, our dream, our imagination, helps us awaken from this dream of being separate and alienated and isolated. So, according to the story, the mythical, semi-mythical, probably totally mythological story about Buddha's first four encounters after he ran out of the kingdom. Sickness, old age, and death. Sick person, old age person, an old person, maybe someone even older than Jeff and me. Is that possible, Jeff? So he was, you know, he was shocked by seeing this sick person with all these cancer sores, depending on the version you read, all these cancer sores all over his body. Then the old age person who was decrepit and could barely raise his head, and then the funeral pyres with all of the smoke. So he was not a happy camper. But then his foresight was to see this monk, this very calm monk, who was just very lightly and very gently moving through the world, and with some joy, with some calmness. And that's when the historical Buddha got his dream. And then he practiced for 6 years. Until he had his awakening, at least according to the story. So, when I met my first teacher, I felt, he really has a calmness and a joy, just a love of everything that you shouldn't even be in love with, but he just is. Like day-old vegetables. Well, I don't want to talk about that now because I would go way off. And I thought, that's my dream. That's my dream, to immerse myself in that, to do whatever he does, so that I can manifest that too. I can wake up to that too. So I went home and told my father, which was a mistake. And my father said, "You're dreaming. You are totally dreaming. This is a fantasy. There's no calmness like this." He said, "I've been around. There's nobody like this. This is a dream." I didn't say anything. I just moved out of the house. I just moved out of the house and moved up to San Francisco to live across the street from my teacher. So, 12 centuries after Chuang Tzu wrote this poem, in the Blue Cliff Records is recorded an exchange with one of his practitioners, which I'm going to read. The practitioner comes to Nan Chuan and says, "Heaven, earth, and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. Isn't this marvelous?" Nan Chuan replies, "People these days see this flower as a dream." So he's just reminding us that we get caught by all of our projections, and instead of just seeing the floor, seeing the sky, seeing the leaves, we see it through this haze that's created by our thinking and by our emotion that we carry around. So then, 100 years after this, after Nan Chuan says this to his practitioner student, Yuan Wu comments, and he says to his student, "Nan Chuan pointed at a flower in the garden and said, 'People these days see this flower as if it were a dream.'" And then he says to his student, and this is in your program, by the way, he says to his student, "Like a person in a dream, though you want to awaken, you cannot wake up." So he's telling a student, "Well, it's wonderful that you have this dream about being calm, but be careful that your sitting doesn't strengthen the illusion that you have this independent self who can actually get calm, that you can actually create this calmness through sitting harder or more da-da-da-da, because you're just perpetuating this sense of an independent, isolated self who can get something." This is called by Katagiri and Suzuki and Okamura, gaining idea. No gaining idea. How many times did they say that to us? No gaining idea. No gaining idea. So the aspiration, the dream without the gaining idea. A little tricky, huh? A little tricky without hardening into the expectation. When we notice it's hardening into the expectation, we have to come back to our heart. To our heart. Like a person in a dream, though you want to awaken, you cannot wake up. Then he says, he goes on to say, this is like leading a man to the edge of a 10,000-foot cliff and giving him a push, causing his life to be cut off. If you were pushed over and over on level ground, you still would be unable to embrace no thingness called by another. You awaken. So he's saying, to awaken from this sense of separate identity that's not joyfully interconnected with the world around us, we have to go up to the edge of a cliff. Our sitting is arduous sometimes. We have lots of difficulties. But when we get up high and the air is really clear, we can see clearly our anxiety, our fear, our difficulty, and we're not trying to mess with it anymore. We're not trying to make it different anymore. High altitude, you can see very clearly. So you can just see it. You can just see it. And then at some point, you are ready to fall off the cliff. To fall off the cliff. Suddenly, a shift takes place. And we're able to do what's necessary to enter that place of possibility beyond the known. Completely beyond the known. You could say into the unknown, but then we get some idea of the unknown. So forget the unknown. Forget the known. Beyond. Beyond. Gone, gone, gone beyond. Gone completely beyond. Awake. We say that every morning here. But saying it is one thing. Doing it is what this is all about. Doing it. If you were pushed over on level ground, you still would be unable to embrace no thingness. Called by another, you awaken. Who is this other who's calling us? Is it God? That's kind of a big name. Is it Buddha? Is it some stillness inside? Is it, what is it? What's being called? What's calling us to be here? To do this difficult sitting day after day? Who's calling us? We give it a name, but it's deeper than any name. We can give it any of those names we want. All those names. That's fine. Buddha nature, that's fine. God nature, that's fine. No Buddha nature, that's fine. It doesn't matter. Suddenly there's a shift. Suddenly there's a shift. And our meditation helps us shift, but also practice in our daily life helps us shift. We can begin to be mindful in our daily life of our tendency to glom together into a tangled mass, or maybe we could say a tangled mess, our perception, our naming the perception, and all of our chattering about the perception. So there's... So my perception, just look. I'm naming it, microphone, and then I'm talking about how its quality and is it reaching that far back, and why is there the static on it, and the static was worse yesterday, and I'm glad Matt helped me prepare it, but he didn't really do a good enough job, and I really need someone else to work on this, but I'm no good at this kind of thing, you know. So we have the perception, we have the naming, and then we've got the very tiring and fatiguing, on and on and on and on and on. Huh. So what is our practice about? It's about helping us get in touch with that initial perception as much as possible. And in Buddhism, in early Buddhism, they talk about kasanas, K-S-A-N-A-S. They say that there, in a minute, there are 75 kasanas, 75 perceptions in a minute. And Katagiri used to go like this. And he said, this is how long a kasana lasts. And the point is that we cover over these kasanas with all of our grumbling and all of our comparing. But we can always come back because they're always happening. They're always happening. So now I'd like to do an exercise, a pre-Memorial Day exercise with the kasanas. So raise this up. You don't have to call it anything. Just raise it up and look at it. You can look at the front or the back, but I don't know what's the front or what's the back. And I'm gonna snap my fingers maybe 20 times. And each time I snap my finger, look at it. And move it a little bit and look at it. And if you're starting to name it or talk about it, when I snap my finger, cut it out. Come back and look at it. All right? Thank you. Thank you. So there's a whole school of Buddhism called Abhidharma, which really gets into this stuff. It gets into this stuff so much that the Heart Sutra had to deny it all. Right, Ben?
Oh, yes.
Because then it became, you know, the true way of being. You got to get in touch with the kasana. Or you're not doing the right practice. But it's still teaching us something. That really the world is always fresh. Fresh, fresh, fresh. Always fresh, fresh. And so it's never too late. Never too late to experience that freshness. Never. That's why even though Jeff and I are getting old, we have a potential to get younger and younger and younger. Right, Jeff? Younger and younger, just through this. Not hard. So, the first dimension. Dreams are like life, and life is like a dream. The second dimension, awakening from the dream of separateness. And partly we're doing that through cocoon practice. That's what that's what Chuang-Tzu is teaching us. Chrysalis practice, cocoon practice. We go into the cocoon to sit in zazen. Before we go in the cocoon, we want to have enough food. Be nutritious, not be too revved up by TV or by Donald Trump or by, you know, our email or, you know, Russia and Trump. My addiction right now is to not do Russia and Trump every time, not to Google Russia and Trump every time I come into the house, but only every other time. That's my goal. Will you help me?
Yes.
So we prepare ourselves to go into the chrysalis, to go into the cocoon. Then once we're in the cocoon, we discipline ourselves not to poke at the cocoon walls. If we poke at those walls, what happens to our zazen? We're not really doing zazen. So we just keep discipline ourselves not to poke at those walls, not to make holes in them. And we practice patience. Patience. How long is this sitting going to last? We forget about it. Patient and trust that this cocoon process will. It works. It's been working for 2,000 years, you guys. It works, this cocoon process. Trust in it. Trust in it. And then we emerge. At some point we emerge. And we fly free of the limitations imposed by gravity. We're not held back by the emotional stickiness of little Tim and all of his needs. We see them. We're compassionate. He acts out some, but we're not limited by that anymore. We're not limited. Last night I dreamed I was a butterfly flitting from flower to flower. Or am I a butterfly now, dreaming he is Chuang Tzu, flitting from word to word? This is called the transformation of things. Third dimension, inner penetration. So, already, everything is interpenetrating everything else. Thich Nhat Hanh's phrase, inner being. Everything is inner being. The chrysalis, the butterfly, life, death, enlightenment, delusion, anxiety, calmness, dreams, wakefulness, it's all interpenetrating. A practitioner says to Nan Chuan, heaven and earth and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. Isn't this marvelous? When everything is viewed as one body of being and mind, everything's okay. Everything's a-okay. Even though specific parts may not realize it's okay and they need support, everything is okay. The Gnostic Gospels say, for I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the barren one and many are her sons. I am the silence that is incomprehensible. I am the utterance of my name. So this huge body of being is my own little aching, deteriorating, lime-infested body. Same. This tiny, mixed-up mind, Trump and Russia mind, is the great mind of the universe. Wow! Everything's interpenetrating. Wow! Not tomorrow. Right now. Right now. It's the third dimension. Fourth dimension is Dogen's dimension. I'll make this one short. Dogen's dimension. Dogen's take on dreams, his take is about personal, rather than trying to wake up, rather than doing in order to or gaining idea, sitting, meditation, living, and personalizing your dream. Without expressing dreams, there are no Buddhas, said Dogen. Without expressing what we deeply care about, what we deeply want, there are no Buddhas. There are no Buddhas. So rather than trying to awaken from something, we fully express our deepest feelings and our aspirations without judging or criticizing. Very simple. Very simple. And of course, sometimes called intimacy. Sometimes called intimacy. So here are two expressions that I'm going to close with. Two expressions by different poets, I guess, not both poets, of Chuang Tzu, of their feeling about the poem after they read Chuang Tzu. The first one is by Octavio Paz. And those of you in study group, we already talked about this stuff, but that's okay. Octavio Paz. A butterfly flew between the cars. Maria Jose said, it must be Chuang Tzu on a tour of New York. But the butterfly didn't know it was a butterfly dreaming it was Chuang Tzu, or Chuang Tzu dreaming he was a butterfly. The butterfly never wondered. It flew. That's Octavio Paz's expression. Now the next one is Basho. Basho in the 18th century. Basho, who is famous for his haiku-type poetry and his Zen practice, He's writing to his friend Doy, whom he hasn't seen in a while, his very close friend Doy. And he says, "You're the butterfly, and I the dreaming heart of Chuang Tzu. You're the butterfly, and I the dreaming heart of Chuang Tzu." So, friendship, right? Intimacy, love, expressing your dream within a dream, within a dream. Love, intimacy, friendship. So, that's what I want to say this morning. I'll be glad to entertain comments or questions from anyone. What comments or questions?
May I say something?
Yeah, sure.
Often I find that when I have the courage to, with my dream, express my beingness, it's not well received. Struggle with attachment to how I am perceived.
Yeah, so she's... Could you guys hear her? I could barely hear her. So she says often when she expresses her dream, it's not well received, and she struggles with that. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes, we struggle with that. It's often not well received. But what choice do we have? What choice do we have? Meaning, we're not here on Earth very long. We really need to do the things that we deeply care about. And if we keep paying attention to what we deeply care about, what we deeply want, and trying to express in some way or another, that's good enough. We're being authentic. Now, that doesn't mean that we should express when we're in a toxic environment. If you find yourself in a toxic environment, that might not be the best situation to express your dream. We need to be careful and choose the right environment. But life is so short. We have to honor what Suzuki Roshi called our inmost request, or we'll be gone. How's that?
Helpful.
Okay. Other people. Okay, well, we'll just sit quietly for 3 or 4 minutes, and if nobody has anything else to say, we'll just be in our chrysalises together. And if someone wants to say something or ask something, that's fine. But I'm not talking about formal sitting. Everybody's getting in a formal sitting posture. Forget formal sitting. We're just being here. We're just being here, okay? Yeah, Matt.
What do you think about lucid dreaming?
Well, lucid dreaming is interesting. And you know, there's a whole technique to lucid dreaming. Do you want to tell them what lucid dreaming is?
It's being aware that you're dreaming in a dream.
Uh-huh. So lucid dreaming has two parts to it. One is being aware that you're dreaming in a dream, and then actually the next night trying to coming back and then working on modifying the dream. That's phase two of lucid dreaming. I think phase one is really cool. And phase two, well, if you get a gaining idea that you put in your dreams, I kind of worry about that. So phase one, when you're just aware that you're dreaming and notice what you're bringing, that's your bare awareness on the cushion. Only you're doing it at night when you're dreaming. That's wonderful you can do that. I wish I could do that. Phase two is kind of manipulative, I think. That's what I think. Yes, Rebecca.
How do you open yourself to being visited by a wolf or a turtle?
Uh-oh. Well, you can just plant that intention into your psyche. You heard my talk today. So you can plant that interest into your psyche and then not be acquisitive about it. Then actually you can plant that intention into your psyche every night before you go to sleep for just 1 minute for as long as you want and see what happens. Now there's all kinds of techniques and stuff, but you know, this is Zen. I'm not so technique oriented myself. Because when we do a technique, we're trying to get something. Which is okay. We need to get some things, but not too many. How's that, Rebecca? And then someone else over here? Yeah.
Kind of answered a little bit there, but I struggle with this notion of when we first come here, we were taught that we're not trying to get to a point or
yeah.
attain something.
Yeah.
As I listened to you today a little bit, there's this notion of attaining your dream state or so forth. So maybe I'm not completely understanding.
Well,
maybe you can balance
well,
that
they're both me. True. I mean, you know. aside from Soto Zen, which comes from Dogen Soto Zen, Buddhism is all about waking up from this dream of separation. And everything talks about that. It all focuses on that. Dogen's thing was, well, you get caught by this idea of waking up, and you're not here. You're not present. The wakefulness is right here if you just completely engaged in the activity. So Dogen reversed it, but most of Buddhism. So we do both. We do both in a non-acquisitive way as much as possible, an aspirational way rather than an acquisitive way. Do you get the difference between aspiration and acquisitiveness when I say that? Does that resonate with you?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've never done lucid dreaming.
You've never what?
I've never done. I guess I've had two experiences in lucid dreaming. But my question is, are there certain things in your dreams, certain people that you might encounter that they may teach you something about, not just yourself, but what, the dream itself?
Yes, you can learn lots of stuff from your dreams. And there are dream practices where people wake up and just record their dreams. I don't do a dream practice, but I've had friends who've done lots of dream practices. You can learn lots of stuff. But again, I think you need to keep yourself an open vessel and not get tangled up in trying to accomplish something through it, because then this is an organic process. Going into this chrysalis is organic. This is what the caterpillar does. And a caterpillar goes into total darkness. It doesn't know anything. And it has some trust that by just staying in total darkness, it will emerge and become more alive. So yes, recording dreams is cool. It's cool. I've had friends who've done that lots. People who journal, often part of their journaling would be they're recording their dreams the night before, from the night before. Yeah, it's cool.
I guess my direct question would be, certain experiences, because I've had these experiences myself, that I've never had any intention. They just come to me.
Yeah.
I meet certain people sometimes in my dreams. They teach me something or learn something from
yes.
myself.
Yes, wonderful.
Is that have you encountered those kinds of things? I try to talk to these things with other people, but they seem to shut down, and there's no way for me to communicate or have some feedback sometimes. So my question is, have you had those kinds of encounters before your dreams without intentionally
putting? Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Our dreams can teach us a lot. I mean, this dream that I... We can all do that. Mm-hmm. And if you've talked to people who dismiss that kind of thing, it's okay, let them dismiss it. Let them dismiss it. Yeah. Yeah.
Say something about, I think I read that in Buddhism.
Pardon?
In Buddhism, when we dream, dreams are just the state of our emotion.
Dream can just what?
The state of our emotion.
Yes, we dream, yes.
Yeah, so those are the dreams. But also, I read a couple of books on out of body experiences.
Yes.
And because we don't know what happens when we sleep,
yeah.
we some people believe that if we just leave our bodies and we live how we live.
Yes.
We don't know really what's happening.
Yes. Yes.
Could be we are really gone.
Yes. Yes.
So we just dream, they are just what they are.
Huh?
They are what they are.
Yeah, they are what they are. So that, so all kinds of things can happen. But we, and that's all cool. It's all cool. Just like lots of stuff happens in our zazen. Sometimes we have wonderful, deep experiences. Sometimes we have awful, just emptying the garbage can experiences. The more we empty the garbage can, the more garbage comes out. Same in our dream. That's true. If you haven't had that experience in zazen, come sit with me for a couple days. And then be honest with yourself. Yeah. You know, people who do ones-on-ones with me, usually it takes them a while to start being honest with me. I remember I didn't want to be honest with my teacher about all my garbage. I thought he wouldn't even want to be in the room with me. Thank you.